This afternoon, we are having our discussion meeting. Now, this is really a very important exercise, a truly serious discipline, a process of learning, growing happily. In the modern world, we are so accustomed to debates, also to conversations, to discussions, exchanges of views, as we call them, in which each person puts forward his ideas or his thoughts, usually rather pell-mell, helter-skelter. One is talking just for the sake of talking, and you will notice how voices begin to rise bit by bit when one wants to assert one's point of view. Now, all this kind of thing is really a squandering of life energy. Very, very rarely only is that sort of conversation or discussion or exchange of views calculated to put us in tune with the rhythm of life. It is just two people talking away at each other. But when instead of two people, we have 20 people, then of course there's pandemonium. One has only to listen quietly for 3 seconds at most to a crowd of people having a meal. Good many of us know what it sounds like in certain places and under certain occasions. Neither is the meal digested properly, nor is the exchange, so-called, of deep thoughts and profound truths of any value, and one just wastes one's time and energy. That is the less serious part of the trouble. There is something else which is really very deep involved in this. When people talk with each other in that manner, they are never conversing. True conversation is a deeply considered exchange. It's an interplay between two people. It is like a poem. It is like music. Melody, its counterpoint, and so on, and the development of that melody and that counterpoint. Then conversation is fruitful. It is true conversation. A talking with each other. It is a communing. To talk together means to communicate with each other. Now, if that which is presented isn't rightly considered and put forward in the right manner, and even more important, if it is not listened to with an open heart and a completely open mind, there is little value in the exchange of mere words, however wonderful sounding they may be. That sound is like the sound of a drum. It's just emptiness, blankness inside. Now, in the old days, there were people who really understood this art of conversation, of discussion, of considering together. Let me repeat the meaning of the word considering. To consider comes from con and sidus, genitive case sideris, a star. Con together with. And a star is a self-shining light, not a borrowed light. It is self-shining because it is alive, it is ablaze, it is giving forth. So consideration, in its profoundest meaning, seems to me to be to look deeply into the light. Now, if conversation or discussion is going to be really worthwhile, instead of mere noise, then let what is said be considered, spoken gently, beautifully, but quite clearly articulated, not mumbled, not rushed through. Give the other person a chance to absorb what you are putting forth. And let it be considered by the other person quietly, deeply, and a response made. Now, as I said earlier, this brings about communion, this sort of communication. You look at the communication that takes place in the world today, especially through the mass media. What is communicated? Horror, misery, the terrible things of life. That's what's communicated, by and large, through the media. And people individually do likewise. We must learn this art of conversation, of considering the other person, what he's trying to put forward. Now, if we do this, there'll be one superb result. Normally, when we talk, there are not two living beings communicating with each other, but two images chattering away. I have a conception of you, an image in my mind, a mental construct. Oh, he is this sort of person, that sort of person, he's going to say this, I know him, and all the rest of it. So I already have an image, and I am listening to that image. I am listening for the things I expect him to say, and I shall interpret all that he says now at this moment according to my fossil of an image of him. Similarly, I have an image of myself as I talk to him. And he has an image of me, and he has an image of himself. The whole thing is a sham. So many ghosts making grimaces at each other. You see, I'm trying to drive home all the different aspects and meanings of silence. In the silence, the fullness of the heart speaks love and truth. And this sort of discipline, which we shall try and practice now, is something which helps towards that. Now, I am going to be quiet. You are going to discuss. I should just like to add one point here. That is, in this process of consideration, don't drive the mind like a man in a hurry drives his donkey or horse. That is to say, don't dig into the storehouse of the discursive thought process. Now what shall I say? What sort of arguments can I bring forward? No. The Quakers have a marvelous way here. They just remain silent until something really sort of comes to life inside. At least that's the theory of it. Comes to life inside. And then that person speaks. Now that is the sort of thing which we should keep in mind.
My first feeling about this question is that it's no method, that it happens.
Let us just repeat the subject under consideration, that if I become free of all personal desire, I would lose drive as far as the world's affairs were concerned, implying therefore that probably I could not participate in it.
Not successfully.
Not successfully participate. So now, that is the question under consideration.
Can I just describe what a young musician friend of mine said about his work, as he called it, that he could have no personal ambition, that his joy was simply to work with a complete choir or orchestra, whatever it might be, and form the most beautiful thing that could be formed between them all, because it was a group.
But I'm thinking of the horrible world of industry and commerce and hard physical labour, not beautiful creative art, which is of course a satisfaction and it animates the soul at the same time. It's quite different.
Couldn't the same thing apply in some quite ordinary capacity if all people were working together in full meditation? That there could be something complete achieved. It surely is up to the people.
I doubt it. In the world as it is, competitive, etc.
But without, if one has lost the desire, then what is the meaning that you won't be successful? I mean, the idea of being successful in the world is when you're still concerned with some kind of desire. Surely you could still do continue doing whatever job you're doing, and the fact that you weren't successful in the worldly sense wouldn't matter to you.
Yes,
surely.
But somebody has to do these things in the world. It's even a duty.
One can still do them, surely.
We had two suggestions about what we should discuss. And the first suggestion was that we should discuss love. And surely the motivation can be living an expression of love. That this also, of course, raises the problem of right livelihood. But if your conscience is satisfied that yours is a right livelihood, then any activity can be seen as an expression of love for one's fellow creatures and as an offering of your own work, the best you can do, whatever it may be, your own skill. But the right livelihood thing is a problem that we have to face in our own lives.
And that surely is whatever we are doing here and now, whether it be in factory or hospital, wherever. It really makes no difference at all. Every single person with whom we come in contact has a contact point. It's just a matter of finding it. It doesn't have to be in a beautiful atmosphere, necessarily.
But it surely has to be a right livelihood. A non-destructive, a non-harming occupation. This is where the difficulty
preferably
comes.
So, but it isn't always possible.
What immediately struck me about it was the question that lack of personal desire would mean lack of any drive in living in the world. It seems to me that when we, as we all do things from personal desire, we're misusing energy, and that if we can let that personal desirousness drop away, we have in fact more energy to apply to the tasks that need doing. And as I think has already been said, it's been suggested that we do them with love to the best of our ability. Does that answer, or will help to answer the question about losing drive? If you lose desire, I feel one would probably have more of the right kind of strength rather than force.
Well, the yoga philosophy is representative of the five, and he has to work in a very competitive world. He has to increase his sales every year in order to retain his post. He's very nice. He's not, I forget what he's working for, but it isn't anything that you could say was a wrong means of livelihood. So I think it's an estate agent or something like that. And it's a very difficult question to answer, I think.
It would be helpful to bear in mind that we are not arguing. We are not trying to make our own point. Nor are we trying to develop a point of view, because that means that the mind is functioning fragmentarily and not in wholeness. That is a defection from true mindfulness, which inevitably goes with true consideration.
Tries it, because sometimes if one does something like this, tries to live on a different level, it ties up with what you were talking about, transformation, not to oneself but to the environment.
Isn't the whole thing bedeviled by christening it right or wrong? Isn't that where the initial mistake lies? Labeling it right or wrong, or good or bad.
Surely in his in that man's job, he can't, if he does lose his personal desire, can't ignore the fact that he's got to use that desire to get anywhere in his job. Surely it would be better for him to change his job.
As Berez has said, we are inclined to look at things in fragments, and from the obvious discussion, all these various points are applicable to the question. I think, first of all, we can't get rid of desire. It is surely the understanding of desire which is what we really must aim at. I, like many of us in the room here, have had the misfortune and the fortune to be in the referees, to try and understand what it is to be in the world, but not of it. It is an acquisitive, competitive society. And of course, as Penny said, right livelihood is something that one must consider if one is in a commercial outfit which is exploiting people or animals or exploitation and cruelty of any kind. Obviously, there can be no reconciliation with leading a decent, honest, let alone religious life. But that world can be a great teacher. And for myself, I feel that the only possible way is to be an example. And one can't just turn on love or turn off desire and say, now I'm going to be a loving person, because as we know from the talks here, it's a lifetime of learning. And I don't know your friend, but your friend is the only person that's going to be able to do this anyway. And I think that it is something that he has to find for himself. And merely the pointers, you can point the way, and remember to keep your eye on the moon and not get lost in the finger. I don't know if that's been any help or a hindrance.
I have found personally that if one is being aware of the apparent problem in one's life, with the passage of time, a way emerges for a change to come about if you don't force it. I have found that one goes on suffering from a situation just so long as one has learned the lesson of that situation. When the lesson has been fully learned, then the situation changes. Something happens if one is patient, being aware that eventually a right way of moving will become apparent. It might be, perhaps, that he is now learning some vital skill which in the fullness of time he can use in another sphere. Being attentive to the situation in which he finds himself is probably just the thing that he needs at this moment, and that seeing time in a different way will remove the urgency of making a change. The change will come about if it's the right thing and he is really trying to do the right thing.
May I say that this man is very much at the beginning. He's just a very beginning inquirer. He's not committed in any way. He comes to our group because he's interested. But he wouldn't understand what you were talking about at his present stage. He hasn't worked that yet. He just wants to know if there are answers to this sort of thing before he could commit himself. Married with a nice house, wife, two children at private school. He couldn't change his job just like that without, throwing up his whole sort of direction in life. It's these people who are difficult to answer, not the evolved ones or the ones who are seriously with one foot on the way. It's the people who want to know if it's compatible with their ordinary life that I find so difficult to answer.
Surely here we're not concerned with other people, it's only ourselves we're putting on it.
Well, I don't know, it's just a question I wanted an answer to. I'm sorry if it doesn't suit me.
Has he assumed that this work is not spiritual or non advancing, or he can't combine the religious life with the work he is now doing?
I think he just wants to know if it's possible of going trials, you see.
Oh, ye of little faith.
Surely the answer is yes. But he should try it if he
is.
And then he would understand what Penny was saying after
he.
Because it doesn't this happen to all of us when we first begin and we start questioning what we're doing, but we realise we can't change immediately. But if we really feel for the religious life anyway, this will evolve and change is just, as Penny said, gradually, very subtly take place. Surely it's worth him trying.
I'll tell you.
You're a young man. Can be compared to somebody who is about to dive into a swimming pool. Surely it is only prudent to make sure that there is water in it first.
There are not two kinds of desire here. The desire which is imposed from without by commercial pressures, and the desire which is of a personal matter, which he can take measure of and say to himself, here is a personal ambition which is running alongside or at variance with the outside pressure. He ought to be able to distinguish between the two kinds of desire. Then I think he'll get his values correctly.
Thank you. That's nice.
One renders unto Caesar that which is Caesar's and that which is God's.
This is a problem which I've had myself, actually, and it gave me a lot of difficulty, so I can understand the problem. I think I'm right in saying that you, just in the same way that you can possess something but not grasp at it, you can continue to do your job but with a different motive. So the motive for doing it is not self-greed, and the wish to, and the ambitious wish to get on higher and higher. But if one takes it as a method of earning money in order to meet one's present commitments, and one can't throw it up, and therefore one does the job for that reason only, that the drive can continue without it being a grasping.
Certainly the husband and wife have to face this together, and he's committed to a way of life that involves a certain expenditure, but if he is made very unhappy by this way of life, He isn't. I would rather my husband had a poor job and was happy doing it than a more lucrative job and was unhappy and couldn't change because of financial commitment.
Oh yes, producing his wife was a nice gay little girl.
There you've touched upon a very profound thing. When he wants it really passionately and he's really unutterably miserable. No, but until he gets to that stage, I doubt very much if he's going to really find the answer. But I do understand this extremely well, and I think we must all of us bear in mind that it is not a thing that can be just lightly dealt with.
It applies to so many people.
You see, you come up against this in relationships in business. You may be in a vast organisation, a corporation, where you have to go before boards, where you have to apply for this, that and t'other. And you are forced into competition. I know, I've had to do it. And so one cannot just very lightly dismiss it and say, oh yes, but he should do this and once he gets there. After all, we are all struggling and disciplining and learning ourselves. So that I think we can safely say that it is something that is very, very complex and not at all easy to just dismiss it with a formula. There isn't a formula for it. It's a very highly individual thing.
No.
I worked on Fleet Street for many years, which is extremely competitive, and it really is a jungle. Quite a lot of people came to this point of wondering if they could lead a different kind of life or not. And it's a very difficult environment to do anything like this. And most of them didn't, with the result that there were quite a lot of breakdowns and two or three suicides. So this does have to be thought about quite seriously. And some small link kept with some group if he really feels like it. So that there is an outlet for him if this desire does get stronger. Isn't something that can be settled now, is it? Not really. Because it will still continue on with him.
There is no answer. I mean, I'm slightly in this dilemma myself. I mean, there isn't an answer. And possibly one often uses one to excuse the other, and to the point. One's always falling between two stools, but this is life, you know, this is how we all live. This is just a rather cut and dry situation, but in every activity the same choice arises.
Need there be a dilemma if one stays where one is, without too much competitive feeling, doing as one should with every person, every single person one comes in contact? Need there be any dilemma? Can't one just accept that where one is?
I haven't felt this from my own experience, obviously, but I'm sure that in the beginning of a competitive job, it's going to be enjoyment. There's going to be enjoyment if you're struggling to get to the top and treading on everyone else. And then if you do think deeply, there's bound to be a rather uncomfortable gap before you realise that you're going to enjoy it without that personal desire. Surely this man is just beginning to get into the gap.
The subject of absence, isn't it also true that one is where one ought to be? One should accept where one is, because
there is a lesson to be learned from that. And in God's good time, if you don't like the job or don't like the situation that you're in, it will work itself out. Provided you learn to act completely unselfishly. Without egotistical desire.
You said within the last couple of days that it's possible to be in a palace and not be tied to that palace. Is it not possible to occupy a job in the same way and not be tied to the job? It seems too that the word drive is a personal thing, whereas possibly it would be better for that man to do whatever he did as well as he could, just for the sake of doing it well. Because this is God's universe and that is the way that we possibly should do everything that we do, rather than from the point of drive, personal ambition. And if he did that, perhaps he might even be more successful than he is now. And might have more strength given to his arm, as long as he's not taking too much from others, of course. Because he's relying on something other than himself. And his own qualities become more naturally developed.
I think he is in a dilemma because I happen to know that if you're in business commercially, people at the top are always wanting to push you down, and it's a very nerve-wracking situation. How can you relinquish desire if you're in a job that's sort of competitive, as the lady said it was? I think the only thing to do is what the young lady said, is to get a job that wasn't so competitive, if his spiritual life is more important to him.
You were talking about this now.
Again. In considering fragmentation and points of view, in the Zen idea, we consider all the relative details, and in arriving at a decision, the movement is usually culminated by taking up self-interest and then acting from that position. So your personal desire, is eliminated. But is it possible, and I pose the question, for us mortals to live other than in fragmentation, in the duality which we perforce we have to exist?
Ask it, Manikar. Feroz has already answered the question. You can only do that when intelligence operates. Then you understand the duals. And then you can live with them.
Are you not still acting from a dualistic point of view by taking sides at some point?
You don't take sides, as I understand it. The perfect way knows no difficulties. It just refuses to have opinions.
At some point it has to act. Unless, of course, action is no action, which it frequently is. I think in the end you have to choose. We have to choose in this life, don't we?
But you choose with intelligence. If your intelligence is operating, your intelligence is love. And you will automatically, you can't do anything else but make the right decision.
At this moment,
because it's a selfless decision. Yeah. as I understand it, I haven't reached that stage, Sydney.
At this moment in time, taking together all the factors that you know of. 10 minutes' time, taking all the factors you know of, it would be a wrong decision, perhaps.
Do you have to come to a decision?
The word decision would be a wrong word, wouldn't it? Because then it's, it has been decided. And the other word might be opinion. And then I remember a Chinese saying, I forget who it was from one of the patriarchs, cherish no opinions. Change them tomorrow, if you like.
Could that be the same thing as an open-ended decision? It is possible to make decisions. One must make decisions. It is possible to make them in such a way that they do leave an avenue for development of the situation of the person concerned. Is that it? There clearly must be a way of action because it's in the Noble Eightfold Path. There must be right action, and this right action is at this moment in time having considered all the alternatives. But it must be some action, even if it's no action.
If I may say something here. When the mind acts, functions in terms of wholeness, and intelligence is really awake, you see the truth of the whole situation, and in seeing the truth of the whole situation, you also act inevitably in conjunction with it. The course of action, which is apparent to the outside world, is the natural expression of your own true perception all the time. We are so conditioned that we believe that first you think a thing out and then you act afterwards. This is perfectly true for the conditioned mind, the mind which is confined to duality, to making choices, coming to decisions, where this decision or choice is at the expense of or against that. But when wholeness is realized, when there is perfect mindfulness, this kind of preferential choice is absent altogether. This kind of particular decision, which always means decision to fulfill a purpose which is self-oriented, is also out. And then action and perception are simultaneous and whole. This is how the yogi, the holy one, acts. And it may be that in so many situations there is no need for physical expression. The actual perception is sufficient, and change, the change of the whole situation proceeds because this person has perceived. You get it in a minor way in our ordinary worldly situations. Supposing there is big committee or a big firm, big business or something, in which there are several executives involved, if some of them have ideas of their own, they get together and discuss things with which the top person or two or three top persons are not in agreement, and these others who have thought out something different know that they will not agree. If by any chance information comes through to the top persons and the top persons have a clear idea of how things should go, it's very curious how that will seep down and influence the psyche of those lower down. It's a curious influence. You see it sometimes operating in a school. Two or three little scallywags are up to something, and they think that the teacher is not looking or doesn't know. Then the teacher gives a gentle glance which brightens a little bit, and the scallywagging has come to an end. It has dispersed it. There was no need for any physical action on the part of the teacher. This I know from my own personal experience.